This is the Medicast, April 9th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 61. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the show. For all of you long-term listeners, hey guys, welcome back. And for you brand new listeners, check out the show, check out the website over at Medicast.com, and get a sense of what the Medicast community is all about. Well, I've got a lot going on this coming week with the next installment of the Medicast Live over at TalkShoe.com. And so I'm looking forward to talking with any of you that can make yourselves available for that live interactive talkcast, which will be this coming Tuesday night, April 10th at 10 p.m. And that's going to be this week's link of the week, so you can head on over to the website and it'll take you directly over there. It's really simple. You sign up for a free TalkShoe.com account, and you can download the TalkShoe chat client software. You'll have a phone number you can call in on as well. Enter the TalkCast ID for the program, and you can enter your PIN number, and you're on live for the Medicast. This week, we're going to be talking about strokes in EMS and stroke care centers. And I'm really looking forward to having that discussion with you. I'm hoping we'll have some other podcasters and EMS bloggers on as well, so we can kind of discuss strokes and whatever else happens to come up on the topic this Tuesday night at the Medicast Live. Well, let's jump into some listener email right away, because I got a couple of really great additions this week to last week's podcast, as well as some other listener mail. Well, the first email I got was from a new listener by the name of Raphael from California. Raphael, welcome to the show. And he has some questions about the different types of pregnancies we might encounter in the field and what we are more likely to see, as well as different information about patient assessments. Well, Raphael, if you check out the website at www.medicast.com, on the left-hand side right there, you'll see a list of different pages. And if you go to the list of tips and tricks, there's a couple of things you'll probably find in there right away. First of all, in episode 15, I did cover tips and tricks on childbirth. And I'll probably cover that one again, because that's something we don't see a lot of, and it behooves us all to kind of revisit that subject periodically. And I like to revisit it too, and so I do it here on the show, and it gets me re-educated. There's also some information in episode 14 about neonatal resuscitation. And patient assessment I talk about quite a bit. There's several different episodes on that list that have to do with different types and areas of patient assessment. So, and you'll have to check that out and kind of figure out which assessment plan you want to look at there. The other thing, Raphael, is I'll be covering in tonight's episode some information on gynecological emergencies and assessment. And you just kind of have to put the whole picture together. I hope that answers your question. I will be covering assessments in more detail on other episodes in specific areas of anatomy and physiology involved in the assessments. So check back with the show, and Raphael, I welcome you to the podcast. Next, I got some email back from quite a few different people talking about the ages for EMTs around the country. And apparently, Maryland is unusual in having a 16-year-old allowance for EMTs. And I was pretty amazed to find that most people seem to have that age set at 18. And I guess I certainly understand why. One email I got specifically from a friend of mine over at the EMS Haiku blog, Eric Augustus, responded back saying that in Oregon, you have to be 18 to obtain your EMT certificate. He doesn't know if there's a specific age in order to start the class, but you have to be 18 at the time of testing. Also, at his particular agency, you actually have to be 21 in order to be hired there, and he thinks that's a combination of auto insurance requirements as well as a company decision. The other thing is that in Oregon, you actually have to get a 2-year Associates of Applied Science degree in order to become a certified paramedic. And a lot of people are coming out of high school and going right into their paramedic program. They obtain their EMTB and then go ahead and get their prerequisites. And the problem is that a lot of times they come and work and they've never really actually been out in the field to any length of time. I agree with you, Eric, on that. I think that is an issue and a problem. And I know here in my area, at least in my region of Maryland, there is a requirement in my county from the medical director that you have to have been an EMT on the street for about a year with a certain number of transports of patients before you can apply for the paramedic program. And I think that's a good idea. I think you really need to have your solid BLS skills in place before you go ahead and start working at your EMTP for paramedic. And you guys can check out Eric's blog over at emshaiku.blogcity.com. And that's blog-city.com. You can also check out the link directly if you head on over to the Medicast site. Scroll down the left-hand side of the blog roll, and those are all the links to the blogs and sites that I link to on the Medicast. And Eric, thanks for your comment. Next up, I have a call that came in by the voicemail line, and you can reach that as well at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And this is from a listener, Steven, and I'll let him pose his question for himself.
Hi, my name's Steven. I'm in Kansas City, and I just started listening to your podcast when I got my iPod last week, and it's definitely an interesting show. I really appreciate you guys doing that. And I do have a question for you. The other day I was on the internet and I ran across a website for a school that's offering paramedic classes in 12 weeks. I'm not sure if you've heard of it or if you may have covered it in a previous podcast, but I would definitely like to know if you have any information or have done any further research into this organization. The name of it is the National Academy for Pre-Hospital Care. They're located in Fremont, Nebraska, just northwest of Omaha. And their website is www.medicschoice.com. That's www.medicschoice.com. And I would like to know if you've taken a look at that website and if you can provide any information about that school, if you've heard anything, and if you think it's a good idea for an academy or a school to offer a paramedic course in that short period of time. Thanks a lot for your help. And again, I appreciate your show. It's very informative, and I look forward to future broadcasts. Thanks. Bye.
Steven, I want to thank you very much for your comments and your praise of the show. I hope that I can continue to live up to that. And Steven did include his email address, but I clipped it neatly out of there using the magic of podcasting. So I'll shoot him back an email as well in case he misses this part of the podcast. But Steven, basically, I have seen something about that particular program. In fact, I have different links show up in my Google advertising on the right-hand side of the website, and I always like to take a look at what kind of sites are being linked there, because sometimes I think if I find something that's a little inappropriate, I can go out and actually block that particular advertiser from my site. So I like to take a look at what's going on there, and I've looked at their webpage and their program. First of all, I think it's a bit pricey, but again, I come from an area and a state that's very supportive of the volunteer service that I belong to, and my paramedic program really was quite inexpensive because of assistance from the state and county in which I live. But the other question you had was about the length of time, and it's basically a program that I think takes place in about 12 weeks, and I think that's a lot to cover in 12 weeks. I know that that does not include any time in clinicals, and they set up those times and places in your area where you live and try to go through hospitals and regions in the area where you are. But I still think that 12 weeks is a really short period of time to cover all of the information covered in a paramedic program. And again, this is a certificate-only program. So if you're in a place like Oregon that requires you to have an associate's degree before you can be certified, well, that's going to cause a separate issue. But if you need just a certificate program and you need to get it quickly and kind of get things out of the way, and you're the kind of student that can really digest that information in an intensive program, then this might be a program for you. Again, I'd check it out. I'd make sure that you got the information about exactly where your clinical experiences were going to be. The program is a 12-week academic program, but you still have your 500 hours or so of clinical time that has to be accomplished before you can go and test for your certification. So check all these things out before you apply to any kind of program. And you might want to check out some other places around the country. I know Acadian Ambulance has a service or a program down in Louisiana. You can check out some of their things. I have a link to their podcast site over at the MedicCast. And there's some other programs out there. So kind of do your homework and investigate. And I'm going to open this up to the listeners. Has anybody else had experiences with this or other intensive paramedic programs? And maybe give us a sense of what you think of the experience if you went through the program or have knowledge of them in a firsthand basis. So we'll look forward to hearing back from other listeners. I think it's time now to jump into this week's news. And the first item I found came up from the Fremont, Nebraska Tribune, and it's their community newspaper there. And it's an interview and article about the stress involving dealing with children as a paramedic and EMT. You know, that when you get that kid that's really, really sick and you really start wondering if you've got the training in the background to get the job done. I know you guys are working hard on staying frosty on these kind of things. And that's because you're listening to this show. You're listening to John Bignell's EMS Live podcast. You're listening to Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast. You're heading over to blogs that I link to and other sites that you find. These are all great ways to stay current on information. And that's what this article basically says. They're talking to their local community about dealing with kids, but they use it as a way of pointing out, first of all, some important preventative measures about children, like seatbelts, bike safety, and things like that. And also the importance of the ongoing training that we do all the time in EMS, whether it's formalized training in a classroom setting or in a drill, or less formal training like reading journals in your time off, in reading back and looking over your notes in your textbooks, even though you've been out of class for some time, or listening to podcasts and checking out EMS blogs. All of these things are great ways to stay current on that information. And another thing about this particular article is it's a great way for you and your small communities to reach out and educate them about what you do and some of the things that you go through. These are things that folks don't often think about. And it's a way to keep EMS and the issues that are important to us in the forefront. So contact your local newspaper. Ask them if they'd like to interview one of your members that's been involved in some recent trauma or recent headline cases there. You can interview them and have them be available for that without violating HIPAA regulations or patient confidentiality. You can do it in such a way as to highlight the types of things that we see on a regular basis and how we can go about educating the public about what we do and teach them a little bit about how to prevent seeing us quite so often. I seem to have found quite a bit of information that jumped out of the news this week relating to pediatric cases, and I'll continue on in that vein. The CDC released a study this week that looked at the number of children hospitalized with cases of pneumonia, and the effect of a 2000 recommendation to vaccinate all children under the age of 2 with 4 doses of a pneumonia vaccine. And this has had a very dramatic effect. In fact, in a study from children hospitalized with pneumonia from 1997 through 2004, They found that 41,000 fewer kids in that age range were hospitalized for pneumonia in 2004 compared with that time 7 years earlier, before the debut of the vaccine. This is a lot of kids. This is a 39% drop in the hospitalizations of infants and toddlers with a very serious illness. I mean, let's face it, if it's just a cold, they go to the doctor and get sent home. We're talking about kids that are sick enough to get put into the hospital. This vaccine is a valuable tool, and I'm going to be covering this later in more detail in the Med of the Week, but it's really important for us to become educated because we are out and talk to the public so often, to educate ourselves on the importance of childhood vaccinations and vaccinations for others in the community that are at risk. In another article having to do with children and teens, I found another study that was looking at the number of children and teens that are being prescribed antidepressant medications. If you recall, I think I talked a little bit about an FDA warning saying that these medications needed to be watched more carefully when being diagnosed for and prescribed for children and teens. And it appears, according to this study, that that has been followed, that there are being fewer and fewer kids being given some of these antidepressant medications. Part of the shift appears to be the shift of getting these kids away from their primary physicians and into the hands of psychiatric professionals. In other words, their primary care pediatricians and family doctors are great at dealing with broad and general issues dealing with health, but they really aren't the best person to monitor someone that has a depressive or bipolar illness. And so by moving these kids into specialist care, they're able to get better prescribed and better monitored in the prescriptions. So while the prescriptions themselves are lessening, there has been an increase in some of the areas of prescribed medications, particularly bupropion or Wellbutrin and some other medications that are in the SSRI or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Some of these are being increased, but they're also being done so under the monitoring of a specialist professional who's better able to handle patients and know some of the danger signs. Whatever the case may be, you need to really get a good drug history on your patients. Don't assume just because you have a young patient that they're not taking any medications, that just because they appear very healthy and don't have any health problems, that they don't have a medication list. So make sure you go ahead and ask that question, not just do you have any health problems, but do you take any medicines every day? Don't just say, you know, what are your prescriptions, but what do you take every day? Sometimes the kids will remind mom and dad, hey, don't I take something every day? Yeah, and the mom and dad can then tell you that they take a medication. And you want to be aware that some of these teens that take antidepressant meds are at a higher risk for having a suicide occur. And we're not exactly sure why there's a counteractive effect. You would think the antidepressants would have a positive effect on this. And some of the evidence is anecdotal, but it's something for us to be aware of and just kind of monitor and pass that information along so that we can make sure that these kids are taken care of well. It appears that the rest of the medical community is doing the same, and we are part of that team, so we need to make sure we're on board with all of this. Finally here, I'm going to wrap up with a story out of the Denver Post, and it has to do with a call for more FAA oversight over air ambulance services, both fixed-wing and helicopter-based services. You know, we see all too many aircraft accidents and crashes involving our comrades that fly air ambulance service around this country. And it's of concern to many of us as to why these accidents happen. What this particular article is pointing at is saying that there's such a push to get profitable in these instances, that these companies that run some of these services, not all of them, I don't want to single anybody out, but that there's a push among the air ambulance services out there to get beyond the envelope of what might be considered safe by some standards, that in the name of having an emergency transport, that it's okay to endanger the lives of the crew to push the envelope when flying in weather that may not be optimal for transport. And I've heard this before from other professionals that are aeromedical EMS professionals, partly from those that are members of government services where their transport is by helicopter with Army-based or police-based helicopter transport services. And one of the comments that's made is that these government-based services have hard numbers, that they will have a visibility of this much or greater. They will have a cloud ceiling of certain amount and higher. And if those numbers are not correct, they will not fly. All transport at that point must be done by ground transport. What some of the for-profit agencies do is they allow their managers to bend the rules a little bit. They get guidelines, but then they're allowed to maybe push that envelope. And this is not necessarily a good thing, of course. It's one thing if you're making that decision and you've got the experience to do so, but if there's a push in the back of your mind, well, we're down 10% in transports this month, and we really need to get our numbers up, and, well, we'll probably make it okay, and the ceiling will probably lift if we get on the other side of this mountain. Well, you know, that just scares me. And quite frankly, it scares other people that I know that have looked at moving into this field, that lack of oversight and lack of regulation is really a problem. So take a look at this article. Maybe I'm being a little too harsh, and I certainly don't want to single out all services for this because I know that air accidents happen. But I think some of the issue can revolve around some of the push for dollars, and we need to be really careful about how we handle that. We don't need to put lives at risk in addition to the saving the patient's life. The people in the air and the crew need to be alive to save the next patient as well. Okay, so the news is done, and that means it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. This week, I'm going to look at gynecological emergencies and really get a handle on how to best assess patients for this. So for those of you like listener Raphael, if you have questions about some assessment tips, this is going to be assessment tips for you based on how to get a women's health history and some of the common things you might be looking for in the field. I have a link in the show notes to a great online version of a PowerPoint presentation on gynecological emergencies. You can head on over to the show notes at medicast.com and you'll find the links to that PowerPoint. And you can kind of run it through it yourself and use it as a refresher. I hit some of the things from that and some of the things from some other sources I have, and I'll just cover them here briefly. First of all, you're likely to see three common problems that are going to lead you to think of gynecological emergencies. First of all, any abdominal pain presentation in a female patient, you need to add to your list of suspicion that there's a gynecological emergency going on. Also, pelvic pain, signs of pelvic infection, and vaginal bleeds are all common presentations of these type of emergencies. Gynecological emergencies are very common, and in fact, they have greater than 1.4 million ER visits per year across the country. That adds up to be about 25 ER visits per 1,000 women, and in the age groups of age 15 to 44, those of generally known as childbearing years, although there can be those outside of those age ranges, of course. Some of the things you're likely to find and may suspect are pelvic inflammatory disease, some kind of genitalia infection or vaginal infection, menstrual disorders, some kind of ectopic pregnancy or uterine pregnancy, as well as other potential illnesses, including trauma. And it provides a problem, first of all, especially if you're a male provider, on how to maintain a professional approach to dealing with patients that have some kind of a gynecological emergency. And the best way to do that is to really keep your game face on, maintain a professional demeanor, and act appropriately at all times. Keep the patient covered unless absolutely necessary. If you do need to visualize, inform them up front that you're going to, what you're going to do, how long you're going to do it for, and then cover them right back up. There's no reason for anyone to be any more uncomfortable than absolutely necessary in this situation. Basically, you can do a lot of your assessment by asking the patient good questions so that you don't have to do an extensive physical visualization of the female genitalia unless you absolutely have to look for things like crowning and childbirth, or if there is definite trauma or signs of trauma that you need to look at very quickly. First of all, you have some questions that you really need to ask. You need to rule out the possibility of pregnancy. And if the patient could be pregnant, that pregnant might be an ectopic or tubal pregnancy where the fertilized egg has settled outside of the uterus and begun and has been implanted and begun to grow. And this is a problem because, of course, the uterus is the only part that's of the female body that's able to handle that pregnancy. And you can cause severe internal bleeding if it's not dealt with right away. You want to know what their pregnancy history is. Not just are they pregnant, but have they been pregnant before? How many pregnancies have they had? If you need to deal with things like a past abortion, no matter what your personal views are about that, you need to be able to handle that question with a non-judgmental reaction. You need to be able to ask that question without being judgmental. So you need to ask the question, so you say, how many pregnancies have you had and how many pregnancies have you carried to term? And they may tell you, well, I've been pregnant twice. I had a miscarriage and I had one pregnancy aborted when I was 15 or 16. Whatever their answer may be, you don't want to make judgments about that. You're just there to get a history on this patient. You want to know what their medications are. Have they had any exposures to any immunocompromising medications that may make them more susceptible to illnesses and infection? You want to know if they're having pain with their periods or dysmenorrhea. This is pain during their menstrual cycle. Is this normal? And does this pain feel like that? Again, you're trying to qualify these things. You're not just asking about, you know, your general pain number, is it a 0 to 10? You also want to ask all of those OPQRST questions. And one of them is this like any other pain you felt? Maybe they say, well, it feels like my normal menstrual pain, but it actually feels worse. It's a stronger pain this time, but it feels the same quality of pain. You also want to know if they have pain during intercourse. And this could be pointing to some other problems. Ask them about pelvic pain and the location of the pain and if there's any radiation or referral of that pain. You also want to know if there's been any signs of bleeding, abnormal vaginal bleeding, abnormal discharge, any change in odor or itching. You want to know if they've had any recent problems or an ongoing chronic problem with bowel or bladder control, as this may also increase their possibilities of infection. You want to know their general sexual history. Are they sexually active? And this goes back to finding out about their possibility of being pregnant. Additionally, you need to ask the question if they have a history of physical or sexual abuse. Find out if this is related to an assault. They may not have reported it that way in the beginning because of family members or maybe the person involved in the assault was standing there. So when you get them alone in the back of the ambulance, you want to again ask this question and do so as non-judgmentally and as compassionately as possible. You also might need to contact local social services or rape crisis centers as appropriate for your community and your own protocols and guidelines. Finally, you want to find out about history of surgical procedures, history of sexually transmitted diseases, and you want to make a cultural assessment of the patient. Some cultures around the world have female genital mutilation as part of their normal cultural practices. And while these are largely outlawed here in the United States and parts of the rest of the world, they still may be carried out. And this may be the result and the source of the traumatic injury or infection. One final tip on visualization of the vaginal area. There's really no need to visualize a patient with vaginal bleeding that is from a non-traumatic cause. You can get all the information you need about that from the patient. Ask them how many pads they've filled up in the last couple of hours or however long they've been having the bleeding. If they're filling up those pads relatively quickly, then that's an indication of the severity of the bleeding. Provide gauze or packing for them, or maybe they have some pads they want to bring along for themselves. Get them to the hospital and let the doctors and nurses perform that kind of visualization if needed. There's really no need for us to do that in the field when it's a non-traumatic situation and we have the materials present to absorb and contain the drainage or the bleeding. So just something to keep in mind, you know, it's just another way to keep you out of getting in trouble by being a little overzealous in your examinations sometimes. And I know you guys aren't the ones that are doing it, but I also know that you all know somebody who has stepped over this line or heard of somebody who stepped over this line. And darn it, I don't want it to be any of the Medicast listeners. There's just no reason for it. So that's my tips and tricks for this week on just some general assessment and history ideas on handling gynecological emergencies. There's so many things this can be that I could go into a whole different seminar on pelvic inflammatory disease, on sexually transmitted diseases, on ectopic pregnancies. But the long and the short of it is there's not a whole lot of this that we can handle in the field other than giving the patient palliative care. If they're pregnant and they're imminently getting ready to deliver, we can certainly take care of that. But everything else really needs to be handled usually surgically or medically at the emergency room. And we just need to be a comforting person and a comforting voice once we get our history to help transport them to the hospital. It's time now for this week's Med of the Week, and this week I'm going to be talking a little bit about the different pneumonia vaccines that are available out there, and this is important stuff. You know, we are out there dealing with patients. Sometimes we're the only primary care providers these patients see outside of a hospital. They don't have family doctors. They don't have access to that ongoing care. So it falls to us to kind of be an information resource, at least to be able to direct the patients to the proper places to receive fuller, I guess that's not a good word, but more complete information and direct them away from internet sources that may be less than reliable. We all know that there's a strong voice out there that is really downplaying the need for vaccination in our society that talks about the causes of autism being related to childhood vaccinations and related to the solutions and manufacturing techniques for some of the vaccines out there. And this is really irresponsible. A lot of these people that are making these claims have other agendas and do not have the scientific research to back up their claims. They are really going on anecdotal evidence. In fact, a lot of these vaccines, most and all of these vaccines, are very safe when administered with appropriate medical history and background checking. And your average family doctor does a very good job of doing that. They're painfully aware of how to take care of these situations. And so we need to be the person out there that says, you know, don't believe that internet report or that guy on the bus that told you that vaccines aren't safe, that they're part of a government plot, or that they will make your child become autistic. This just isn't true, and it's been proven. They've gone out there and done the scientific studies and proven this again and again. And we need to be a resource of solid information on this. So I'll step down off my soapbox here and get right on into the different pneumonia vaccines. Pneumococcal disease are infections caused by a bacteria, Streptococcus pneumoniae. Streptococcus pneumoniae causes many common infections, including middle ear infections. However, these infections can also move forward to cause pneumonia and meningitis, both very serious infections, as well as a systemic blood infection or septicemia. For the very young, the very old, and those that have immunocompromised illnesses, these diseases can be fatal. And so we need to make sure that we provide some protection for them. In the U.S., there are 700 cases of meningitis related to this bacteria, 17,000 cases of septicemia and other invasive diseases in children under the age of 5. So, who's at most at risk? Well, as I said, the very old, the very young, and those with some kind of immunosuppressive chemotherapy or congenital or acquired immune deficiencies, as well as those with renal diseases and members of certain populations, including the Native Americans, Alaskan Natives, and African American children. As I said, there are two different vaccines. The first is the vaccine called Prevnar by its trade name, also known as the PCV vaccine version. And this is the one that's given to all infants less than 24 months of age, and it's typically given at the ages of 2, 4, and 6 months of age, and then a booster dose sometime between 12 and 15 months of age. Now, at any time, if they miss a dose, they can be started on later in age. And of course, children over the age of 2 can be given a different dose range. You can check with your pediatrician or your local care providers, but it's important for us to maybe ask the question, have your child been vaccinated for the pneumococcal vaccine or PCV vaccine? For those over the age of 24 months and all the way up to the very elderly, there is the PPV version of this vaccine, and this is known as Pneumovax or New Immune, PNU, immune. And these are a different composition of vaccine that's safer for older patients than two. And these are usually given as a single dose and then follow-up boosters as advised by the physician. Again, these are questions that are asked in almost every hospital around the country when the patient is brought into the emergency room. One of the questions that's asked is, have you had a pneumococcal vaccine? And if the answer is no, or the patient is unsure and a search of their medical records is unable to turn up any evidence, they're going to probably be asked to go ahead and get that vaccine if they'd like. So we need to educate the public on what these vaccines do, on how they specifically can save the patient, and educate the public on the fact that these vaccines are very safe and proven safe and proven effective at reducing the number of hospitalizations. It's a very simple vaccine, and it's just something we need to be aware of. We need to be the proponents of public health in our communities. We need to be providers of good medical information and be people that people can trust to come to and start the asking of these questions. Yeah, we're not their doctor, but for some people, they don't have the doctor of their own. And so they ask the medical professionals that they come in contact with. And if that's us, we can at least point them in the right direction. Contact your local health departments. Talk to your local emergency rooms. Maybe they have some resources for you, some handouts, some pamphlets that you can keep available when questions about things like this come up. And you can be a resource for them to forward information onto the community. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank all of you for checking the show out. Remember, you can contact me here at podmedic@mac.com by email. You can also check out the website at www.medicast.com. And over there, you can leave comments on each of the entries over there at the Medicast site. Although I had a short posting week this week because of the Easter holiday and some family things going on, I usually get up and post up there about 4 or 5 times a week in addition to the show notes, extra articles, extra information, extra links to things that I think might be of interest to you, the Medicast listeners. So head on over to the Medicast site and check that out and leave comments over there. And there's a great discussion going on all the time on some of those postings, and you can check it out for yourself. As always, you can leave a voicemail message for me here at the Medicast at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC, and maybe you'll get your voicemail played just like Steven did tonight. If you'd like to get onto the Medicast newsletter list, you'll get an email every week when the podcast is posted with all of the links directly to your email box, so you can listen to the show and head right in there and get your links. You will also get an extra free Medicast tip of the week just for newsletter subscribers. Just a little something extra for you that subscribe to the newsletter. The newsletter is absolutely free to sign up for. You can head on over to the Medicast site in the upper right-hand corner and click on the link there for the newsletter and get signed up now for the Medicast newsletter. I'll wrap up as I always do with some excellent PodSafe music, this week by the artist Johanna Staley. I've featured her music in the past on the show. She's a great supporter of the Medicast, and I certainly appreciate that. And she's got a lot of great music, so I'm going to play another one of her tracks here tonight. This song is called I'm Not Perfect. And it's a great tune, I think, for us in the EMS field. You know, we're not always perfect, but we always strive to be so. And by staying better educated, by talking to each other and sharing information, we can at least be as close to perfect as is humanly possible for us in the field by being educated and staying current on our protocols. In the meantime, we'll listen to Johanna as she sends us out into our week, and I want to thank Johanna again for supporting the Medicast. This is Johanna Staley's I'm Not Perfect. Until next week, or at least until the Medicast Live this Tuesday night, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Johanna Staley, and you're about to listen to some music from my CD, I'm Not Perfect. I want to thank you guys for making such a difference. Keep up the good work.
Take that, I take it back. You can hold me down.